right, and I joined the ranks of the other men and women who'd been kept to work. At least I hoped that was the group I had been assigned to. Beside the new prisoners, the older prisoners like me looked pathetically weak and incapable of any kind of real labor.
"Where are they taking my wife and son?"
the man who had been ahead of me asked the capo. The capo cuffed him with his club, making the man's lip bleed.
"They're going to the gas chambers! Now shut up unless you want to join them!"
For a moment, it looked like the man might say that he would.
"Save your own life," someone whispered behind him. "Just let them go. It's better for them this way."
"How can I let them go?"
the man cried.
"They're my family. I love them."
But he stayed where he was, holding the back of his hand to his bleeding lip as he wept. When the selection was finished, one of the brown shirts addressed our group. Herr Dr. Mengele was done for the day.
"Prisoners," the brown shirt said. "You are fortunate. You are strong enough to have been selected for work. Once all the Jews of Europe are collected into our camps, we will organize a new Jewish state for you, where you will be free."
The new prisoners looked at one another hopefully. Some of them, like the man who'd been in front of me in line, no doubt thought this meant that his wife and son were still alive and just taken to a different part of the camp. They didn't know the games the Nazis played yet. The lies they told us, for sport.
"You will be happy to know, too, that your stay here in the camp will cost you nothing. All the valuables you brought with you are at this moment being distributed among the camps, where they will be used exclusively for the benefit of the Jews."
Another lie. At Birkenau, we had seen the stockpiles of riches in Canada, the camp storehouse. We had seen how the Nazis made the warehouse their own personal shopping center before shipping trainloads of gold and silver back to Berlin.
"Work," the officer urged us. "Work will set you free. If you work hard, if you perform your duties faithfully, you may be attached to the Wehrmacht as service personnel. From there, you may even earn positions of authority within the new Jewish state."
The new prisoners nodded, buying it hook, line, and sinker. I didn't have the heart to tell any of the new Jews it was all a pack of lies when the roll call was finished and we were sent to our new barracks. No one did. The new prisoners would learn soon enough, and they would accept the truth, or they would die. That night, as I lay in the middle slot of my three-tiered bunk, I heard voices in the distance singing. I couldn't believe it, and I lifted my head to hear better. It was a lullaby my mother had sung to me when I was a child, but it sounded like it was being sung by a choir. Had I finally lost my mind? Was I going crazy?
"It's the women,"
the man next to me in the bunk whispered. "They sing when mothers and their children are taken to the gas chambers." I listened to their song, distant and plaintive. "How often do they sing?" I asked. "All day," the man said. "All day and every night." Chapter 20. Sometimes in the morning, prisoners didn't wake up. They were dead or dying. The guards would come in and beat their bodies to make sure they weren't faking it. And while we were gone to roll call or on a work detail, the bodies would disappear, carted off to the furnaces to burn like the rest. One morning, the man in the bunk next to me didn't wake. I knew what death looked like by now. Death and I had become old acquaintances. We knew each other when we passed on the street. This man was dead, I was sure.
"What is it?"
another prisoner asked me. He was a boy, like me, maybe 1 or 2 years older.
"This man is dead," I told him.
The boy poked him to be sure, then looked around to see if the capos were coming yet.
"Go through his pockets,"
he said.
"What?"
I was momentarily surprised by his words.
"See if he still has any bread on him."
It sounded awful, but if the man did have food on him, he definitely didn't need it anymore. I put my hands in the pockets of his striped jacket and found a lice-ridden piece of bread from last night's dinner. I brushed off the lice, tore the bread in half, and gave half to the other boy. We scarfed down the bread before the capos came. The boy introduced himself to me as Fred. I told him my name. Yannick. Not B3087. I hadn't spoken my name to anyone for as long as I could remember. Fred and I shook hands. It was the first intentional contact I'd had with anyone at the camp since Uncle Moshe had died. We were all the time touching other people, lined up at roll call, at work, in line to get food, in bed at night. But I hadn't shaken hands or hugged anyone on purpose in months. It felt good to connect with someone, even though Uncle Moshe's words came back to me again. You have no name, no personality, no family, no friends. Nothing to identify you, nothing to care about. Not if you want to survive. Fred and I stood together at roll call, but of course, we didn't say a word to each other the whole time. When it was time for work detail, we were assigned together to the gravel pit, where we worked side by side breaking rocks.
Where are you from?
Fred asked me while we worked. I hesitated, remembering Uncle Moshe's warnings. But Fred was the first person close to my age I'd met since hiding under the floors at Poishof with Isaac and Thomas. I loved just talking again. Being human.
Krakow,
I told him.
Me too,
Fred said. We compared streets and discovered we had grown up not too far from each other. We even went to some of the same parks and stores.
Every day I would walk my sister to school down Krakuza Street,
he said, remembering. Then he got very quiet.
Where is she now?
I asked.
She and my parents came here with me.
I was sent to the right. They were sent to the left. I knew what that meant. We all did. His family was dead. Overhead we heard the drone of airplanes, and we all looked up.
British planes,
someone whispered. I didn't know how they could tell, but I hoped they were right. British planes meant the Allies were advancing, taking the fight to the Germans. The Allies were the forces aligned against Germany, England, France, America, and the rest. The capos cracked their whips and made us all get back to work, but soon we heard explosions in the distance. The Allies were bombing close by.
Sometimes I wish the Allies would drop bombs on us,
Fred said quietly.
Blow this place to bits, and all the Nazis and capos with it. And me too. We can't give up,
I told him.
We have to survive.
Fred tried to smile, but I could tell he was still thinking about his family. He didn't say anything more the rest of the morning. It was only at lunch that he felt like talking again. He lifted a spoonful of the tepid, flavorless broth and poured it back into his bowl. You'll know what I'm going to do first thing when I get out of the camps? I'm going to buy a big, warm, golden loaf of bread. Then I'm going to slice off a thick piece, and I'm going to spread butter all over it and eat it in 3 bites. I laughed.
I'll take 5 pastries.
Oh, and bagels, 3 of those.
With cream cheese.
Carrot cake with walnuts.
Chocolate pudding.
Just talking about all that delicious food made my stomach rumble, but it was fun to dream. We kept up our running menu all through work in the gravel pit that afternoon and into the evening in the barracks while we lay next to each other on our shelf.
Fresh challah bread,
I said.
Sauerkraut.
Mushroom soup.
Stuffed cabbage.
Will you two shut up about food?
A prisoner near us yelled at last.
I can't stand it any longer.
Fred and I laughed, but we stopped. It was best that we got as much sleep as we could anyway. We had a hard day's work ahead of us, and nothing good to eat. Fred and I became inseparable in the camp. We stood together at roll call, we ate together, we tried to get on the same work details, we slept beside each other at night. It was good to have a friend. But one day, I noticed Fred was slower at chopping wood than he had been the day before, and at dinner he wouldn't eat his bread.
What's wrong, Fred?
I don't feel good.
he told me. He gave me his bread and climbed up into bed. I saved the bread for him in my pocket. He would want it tomorrow, I was sure. But he didn't want it then. He didn't eat his soup at lunch either. I had to do some of his work at the timber yard to cover for him too. That night as we lay on our shelf, I whispered to him that he had to get better.
I can't, Yannick. It hurts.
What does?
My stomach. My head. My throat.
Fred was sick. There was no doubt about it. But you couldn't get sick in the camps. Not so sick you couldn't work. There was a camp clinic, but no one wanted to go there. People didn't come back from the camp clinic.
You'll be better tomorrow,
I told Fred.
I saved you some bread for when you're better.
Fred wasn't better the next day. He was worse. He couldn't even get out of bed.
Fred, you have to get up,
I told him.
You have to move. The capo will come for you soon.
No,
Fred moaned.
No, Yannick. Go. You have to go.
What's this? What's going on?
An angry voice demanded. It was our barrack capo. He pushed me aside and poked Fred with his club.
Get up! Time for roll call!
He can't,
I told the capo.
He's sick.
The capo struck me with his club, sending me to the floor. I put my hand to my ear and felt blood.
Get up!
The capo told Fred again. He hit him with the club, and Fred moaned. I stood up and was about to grab the capo to try and stop him, but another prisoner took me by the arm.
Come away,
he whispered.
Come away, boy.
The capo hit Fred again, and again.
Fred!
I yelled.
Get to roll call or you'll get a beating,
the capo threatened me.
Yannick,
Fred moaned.
Go, please.
The capo hit him again as the other prisoner pulled me away.
He's going to kill him,
I pleaded with the man.
Yes, and he'll kill you too if you interfere. Is that what you want?
I stood in line at the roll call, watching for Fred. He had to get up. He could make it. He wasn't a Musulman yet. He was just sick. He would get better. Fred arrived at roll call at the very end, but only because he was dragged there by two capos. His face was bloody where they'd beaten him, and he hung limp, not even trying to stand. I fought back the tears that came to my eyes. The capos hauled Fred to the front of the assembly yard where a gallows was built. It was a simple thing. Just two standing poles with a bar between them. From the pole hung a rope with a noose tied at the end. The two capos lifted Fred's neck into the noose and tightened it, leaving a chair under his feet to keep him from hanging. He was so weak he couldn't even stand. And the rope cut into his neck, turning his face blue. I choked back a sob.
This man says he cannot work,
a Nazi told us.
No, I thought. No, he can. He's a good worker. He's just sick.
Work makes you free,
the Nazi told us.
But if you cannot work...
The Nazi nodded to the capos, and one of them kicked the chair out from under Fred. He lifted his head for just a moment, long enough for me to see his horrified face. And then I couldn't watch anymore. That night, I set a kaddish for Fred as I ate his bread and made another vow never to forget.
Death March, 1945. Chapter 21. One morning after roll call at Auschwitz, we were told we were being moved. All of us. I had never counted, but there had to be 5,000 of us at roll call every day, give or take a few hundred. Workers were needed in the Sachsenhausen concentration camp, the officer of the watch told us, and we were being sent to fill their barracks. I could feel the other prisoners tensing around me. If we could have whispered and talked, we would have. Every day, Allied planes flew overhead, and the bombs they dropped got closer. Sometimes at night, we would even hear the sound of guns. Big guns, tank guns, anti-aircraft guns. At the beginning of the war, the Germans had taken the fight to France, to Belgium, to Holland, to Russia. Now the fight was happening in Germany. So when the Nazis said they were moving us to Sachsenhausen because the camp needed workers, none of us believed them. The Allies were getting closer. They were pushing back. Any day now we might be liberated. That was the talk in the barracks. The Nazis were probably moving us away from the front lines. There were no trains to take us to Sachsenhausen, the watch officer told us, so we would walk. That was another good sign for the end of the war, if the Germans had to use all their trains for the war effort. But it was bad for us. I had no idea where Sachsenhausen was, or how far we would have to go. But just the thought of walking all day made me feel exhausted. There were others, I knew, who would never make it a kilometer. But walk we would, some in bare feet, and some in odd-sized wooden clogs, in our thin uniforms, in the middle of winter. The Nazis gave us each a half a loaf of bread, and told us it was to last us the whole trip. But how many days would that be? None of us dared ask. I decided right away that I would eat just a bit of my bread at a time to make it last. If I ended up with extra, I would eat the rest at Sachsenhausen. Under the whips and clubs of capos and SS officers, we marched out through the front of Auschwitz. You come in through the front gate, but the only way you leave is through the chimney, the guards had told us when we arrived. Ha! Look at me now, I wanted to shout. Walking out through the front gate the way I came in. I had survived the ghetto, I had survived Płaszów, and Wieliczka, and Chabinia, and Birkenau, and now, Auschwitz. I was going to survive it all. I was going to be alive when the Allies liberated us. This I swore. But nothing had prepared me for the death march. That is what we began to call it, as our numbers dwindled. We marched for hours upon hours each day, stumbling and staggering along as best we could. We walked, and we walked, and we walked. And I began to think there was no Sachsenhausen, that the Nazis merely meant to walk us to death. Those who could not keep up were shot and left by the roadside. The crack of guns behind us was our constant companion, and you knew you had slowed too much if the guns got too loud. Snow fell on us most days, and the dirt road we walked on was frozen when we were lucky, freezing slush when we were not. Those without shoes were the first to fall behind and die. Some tore strips from their canvas jackets and wrapped them around their bare feet, but once the canvas got wet, it was worse. I at least had wooden clogs to keep my feet off the frozen earth, but without socks, my feet were blocks of ice anyway. There was no water. We ate snow when we stopped for the night, caught flakes on our tongues as we walked. We slept in the open when there was no barn or shed to be found, which was most nights, sleeping on top of one another like dogs for the warmth. The capos and Nazis had fires to keep them warm. At least in the camps we had shelter to keep the weather off us at night. Out here, the elements killed more prisoners than our guards did. On the fifth day, or was it the sixth, I had lost count. I woke up, and I was sure I couldn't go on any farther. My arms and legs were so cold I couldn't make them move in the morning, and I was sure a Nazi would shoot me. But there were others like me. Many others. One man's ear had frozen to the ground in the night. The Nazis gave us time to wake and stir before resuming the march, which was a small mercy. Perhaps they just didn't have bullets for us all. As we shambled along later that day, I looked at the men around me. We were skeletons. Ghosts. Filthy, toothless creatures in oversized, soiled prisoner uniforms. The hair on our heads was growing in thin and scraggly from not too recent shavings. Our fingers were long and bony like vampires from some Hollywood horror movie. The skin on our faces cracked and drawn back like mummies. The older men had the beginnings of beards on their gray skin, and we all walked like zombies, stumbling more than striding, trying always to stay just one step ahead of the Nazis and their guns. Not long ago, all these half-dead creatures around me had been people, I realized. Which of them had been doctors? Teachers? Musicians? Businessmen like my father? Which of the boys had been students like me, playing ball in the streets after school, laughing and calling to their friends? It seemed like a lifetime ago. Years. How many years? Like the days, I was beginning to lose count. 5 years? 6? Had it been that long? I had been 10 when the war started. That made me 16 years old now. I should almost be done with school and thinking about a career, or maybe even university. Mother and father had always wanted me to go to university, but there had been plenty of time to think about that, once. Years and years to prepare. Years that were gone now. Stolen from me by the Nazis. I closed my eyes, half walking and half sleeping, listening always for the crack of the guns at my heels to know when to pick up my pace. There was the danger of passing out, of being shot while I slept. But I couldn't help it. I had only half my bread left, tucked into the waist of my pants. I had stretched it as far as it would go, and still I had no energy left to walk. Something droned in the distance, in our shambling column, so much smaller now than when we had begun our journey. Slowed to look up. 3 enormous planes flew by, high up in the clouds, raining tiny black specks from their bellies. Bombs. They were Allied planes dropping bombs somewhere in the distance. We heard the rumble of explosions and saw smoke rise over a hill on the horizon. I wanted to cheer them on, to raise my fists and cry, "Yes! Yes! Stick it to the Nazis!" But I knew I had to keep silent. I wasn't sure I had the strength to shout anyway. The capos cracked their whips and we got moving again. But secretly, I was still urging the Allies on to victory. One of the prisoners began to sing. He was Czech, I think. It sounded like Czech, from what I'd heard of it in the camps.
"Bevavelo dobre. Bevavelo dobre,"
he sang, his voice weak but insistent.
"Ze nazich mladech let. Beval svet jako kvet."
I tensed, sure one of the soldiers would shoot him. But they let him continue. Another prisoner, another Czech farther along the line, joined him, and then another behind me. Then a Pole beside me began to sing, and I recognized the refrain.
"Hey, hey, hey, falcons, past the mountains, forests, pits. Ring, 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 my little bell, in the steppe. Ring, ring, ring. Sorry. Sorry for the girl, for the green Ukraine. Sorry. Sorry your heart is weeping. I'll never see you again."
Another Pole took up "Hey Falcons" with him, and then there was a chorus. Then the German Jews began to sing a different song, and the Italian Jews another. I heard a Dutch voice, and an English one. And behind me came the most beautiful French voice I had ever heard, though I didn't understand a word of his song. We sang as we walked, all of us, singing 100 different songs, and the Nazis let us sing. Another small mercy. Or perhaps they too missed the way the world had been before the war. Chapter 22. 9 days into our long march. Or was it 10? I found myself walking next to another boy about my age. His face was red, and his eyes were half shut, and he staggered with each step. He was about as close to a Muslim as you can get without actually being one, without crumpling to the ground and not being able to get up again. He almost swayed into me once, so I picked up my pace and got ahead of him. I couldn't stop thinking about him, though. He reminded me of Fred, sick in his bed and not able to get up and work. Fred, who had been such a friend to me when I had so desperately wanted one, needed one, at Auschwitz. I kept looking back at the boy, watching him weave through the shuffling lines. Once he stumbled and fell, only climbing back to his feet after a struggle. Very soon now he would be at the back of the lines, where the SS and their pistols waited. I couldn't help it. I had to go back to him. I slowed down until we were alongside each other.
"Hey,"
I said.
"Hey, you have to walk faster."
The boy said nothing. There was no life in his eyes, no hint that he'd even heard me. I grabbed his arm.
"Hey, listen to me. Just one more day, yes? You can make it one more day, and then you can sleep tonight and start tomorrow fresh. You just have to keep walking."
The boy tripped and stumbled into me, and I caught him. I propped him up under his shoulder, letting him lean on me, but he never broke away. Perhaps his body knew that if he let go, he would fall again. He slumped against me, and suddenly I was carrying half the boy's weight. He wasn't really heavy. None of us were anymore. But I was already so weak and tired from the march and from eating my bread sparingly that I barely had the strength to carry myself. Within just a few meters, I stumbled under the weight of him, but I didn't let go. What was I doing? Had I gone crazy? Uncle Moshe would be scolding me right now. I could hear his voice. "We have only one purpose now. Survive. Survive at all costs, Yannick." Each step I took was harder than the last. Why was I wasting my energy carrying along a sick boy who would most likely be dead before we got to Sachsenhausen? I hadn't thought this through, and now here I was holding the boy up. "I should let him go," I thought over and over. "Let him make his own way. I should save myself." That was how you survived the camps. You saved yourself. No one else was going to do it for you. But this boy had a face. He had a name too, though I didn't know it. He had a mother and father, probably dead now, but he had family. A home somewhere. He could have been me. He could have been Yannick Gruner, son of Oscar and Mina, of 20 Krakusa Street, Podgorze, Krakow. If it were me, wouldn't I want someone to help me? Even if I was out of my mind with hunger and exhaustion, wouldn't I want the boy who was helping me to stay there under my arm? To help me just a little farther along the way? Surely somebody else had to feel the same way. If I could just find someone to help me, if we shared the load, we would all make it. Even this nameless boy.
"Please,"
I said to the man nearest me.
"Please, help me."
The man heard me, but he wouldn't look at me. Instead, he picked up his pace and left us behind.
"Just help me carry him,"
I begged another man.
"Don't be a fool,"
the man said, and he too moved away.
"Leave him,"
another prisoner told me.
"He's going to die anyway,"
said another.
"Let him go, or he'll take you with him." Crack! I jumped.
Somewhere behind us, another prisoner had fallen too far behind, and the Nazis had shot him. They would shoot me too if we fell behind, even though I wasn't the sick one.
Why wouldn't someone help us? It didn't have to be this way, every man for himself. If we all helped one another, if we became one another's family now, when all of our real families had been taken from us, we could be stronger. More of us could survive.
But too many of them thought like Uncle Moshe. Too many of them would only look out for themselves. I wanted to yell at them, argue with them. But I was too tired. It wouldn't do any good anyway. I was right. But so were they. In their way. The only person you could trust in the camps was yourself. I should never have helped the boy. I knew that. But now that I was helping him, I refused to let him go. I was becoming stubborn now that I was 16. I walked along giving the nameless boy all the energy I could spare. I longed to have a bite of my bread, but it was tucked into the waistband of my pants behind my back, and I couldn't reach it and carry the boy at the same time. I would have to wait for nightfall and our scheduled stop before I could eat again.
It was better that way, I figured. My bread would last longer, so long as I survived to eat it. But as we walked along, step after step, kilometer after kilometer, my stomach began to gnaw away at itself. I was so hungry. Just a bite of bread, just a pinch, and I could quiet my aching stomach for a few more hours. The only way to eat was to let go of the boy, though, and we were already near the back of the lines. I couldn't stop, but I was so hungry I cried. The gray clouds in the sky meant more snow, but they also meant night would come earlier, and maybe an earlier end to the day's marching. Just a little farther, I told myself. One more step, then another. If I fell, it would be hard for me to get up again, and impossible for me to lift the boy. If I dropped him now, all this torture would have been for nothing, and that seemed worse than having helped him to begin with. But I wasn't going to make it to nightfall. Not even with the gray clouds overhead. Just when I thought I couldn't take another step, my load lightened. Another prisoner stepped in to take the boy's other arm. He was an old man with sunken, bloodshot eyes, deep cracks in his face, and a grizzled beard. He looked like I might be carrying him next.
"Can't walk so well myself," he rasped. "But I'll help you the rest of the way today."
Tears streamed down my face. I should have said thank you, but I was too tired to speak. The old man seemed to understand.
"Keep walking,"
he told me. We walked along in silence the rest of the evening, the only sounds the crunch of the frozen mud beneath our feet and the cracks of the capo's whips. I tried to block out everything else and focused on putting one foot in front of the other. It was still a struggle to carry the boy, but with someone else to help, I was rejuvenated. Darkness had long since fallen when we reached the top of a hill and found no barn or house in sight. The guard stopped us and told us the frozen ground would once again be our bed. None of us complained. My companion and I dropped the boy to the ground as quickly as we could, and before I could thank him, he disappeared into the crowd of prisoners huddling together for warmth as they slept. I stood over the boy a moment longer, wondering what his name was, and if he would even survive the night. His breath was ragged, and his body barely moved. Had I used up all that energy for nothing? Before I could sleep, I had to eat. I reached for what was left of my half loaf of bread tucked into my pants. But it wasn't there. In a panic, I patted all around my waistline, even checking to see if it had slid down inside my pants. I was so cold and my pants were so big I might not have noticed. But there was nothing there. My bread was gone. It must have slid out while I was carrying the boy and I hadn't noticed. Half of my food. Lost. And who knew how much longer we would be walking? I fell to my knees sobbing. Without food, I would never survive. I looked down at the nameless boy again, and my hands made fists. I wanted to hit him. It was all his fault. I would never have wasted all that energy, would never have lost my food if it wasn't for him. But I pounded my own bony legs instead. It wasn't the boy's fault. It was mine, and I knew it. And then I saw it. A lump in the boy's pocket. What was left of his bread. It was as much as I'd lost. Maybe more. I reached a hand out to take the bread from the boy's pocket. But I stopped. Had it come to this? Was I so desperate to survive that I would steal bread from a sick boy? I quickly moved behind the boy and nestled in close, so we could keep each other warm in the night. But as I lay there under the starless black sky, my stomach moaning, or was it me moaning? All I could think about was that bit of bread. So little I might have left it on my plate after dinner once, a long time ago, before the war. But now that little bit of bread was everything. It was the difference between life and death.
He's sick, I told myself. He's mostly dead already. He's a Musulman. In the morning he won't be able to get up and they'll shoot him where he lies. He doesn't need that bread. It would probably make him sick to eat it now anyway. If I take it, at least one of us will survive. Face it, I told myself. He'll be dead by morning. Still, I couldn't take it. Not when I could feel him breathing. Not when I could feel his heart beating in his bony chest. He might die by morning. Probably would. But I could wait until then. I would not steal bread from another living prisoner. Instead, I closed my eyes and hoped that sleep would at least let me forget my hunger for a few hours. It was my stomach that woke me the next morning, more than the light. My first thought was the boy's bread, but the rise and fall of the boy's chest told me he hadn't died in the night. He was still alive. How was it possible? And not only was he alive, but his breath was much less shallow. There was color in his face again, too. The sleep had done what I promised him it would. It had given him the rest he needed to face a new day of marching. I shook with anger and frustration. He was supposed to die. I needed him to die so I could have his bread. I closed my eyes. What was I thinking? I wouldn't steal bread from a living boy, but I would wish death on him so I could take it without guilt? What were the camps doing to me? What had the Nazis turned me into? Faced with two evils, stealing from a living boy, or wishing him dead to take his food guilt-free, I realized I could more easily have the sin of stealing on my conscience. I needed that bread to live, and I was going to take it. The boy owed me, after all. He was alive only because I had helped him. Slowly, my hand shaking, I reached around the nameless boy for the bread sticking out of his pocket. I touched it. I had it in my fingers when the boy's eyes opened wide and he stirred. "Hey, what are you doing?" he said. I yanked my hand back. "Nothing. I was just trying to see if you were still alive." The boy pushed the bread farther down into his pocket. "Well, I am," the boy told me. He pushed himself to his feet. "Wait," I said. "I'm the one who helped you yesterday." I started to say, but without so much as a thank you, the boy staggered away to join the march. I would have cried again, but I was too tired. A capo came around kicking the last of us still on the ground, and I picked myself up. I wasn't a Musulman. I might be starving, and I might be that nameless boy the others saw staggering through the ranks by midday, but I wasn't dead yet. My name was still Yannick, and I was going to survive. Sachsenhausen Concentration Camp, 1945. Chapter 23. 3 days later, I staggered through the gates of Sachsenhausen. I barely knew where I was, or who I was. All I remembered of the last 3 days was an enormous radio tower in the distance, growing larger and larger as we marched.
"That's Berlin,"
someone had said.
"That tower is in Berlin."
The tower was in Berlin, but we weren't. We were in Sachsenhausen, and I was so tired and hungry that I didn't care if I lived or died. Death seemed like such a welcome release. If the Nazis had put us right to work, I might have died that day. I might have curled up on the ground like a Musulman and never gotten up again. But they sent us to our barracks instead, where they fed us soup and bread. I was starving. I had been without food for days now, with only snow to eat each morning before we began to walk again. But all I wanted to do was sleep. When would they let us lie down? They wouldn't let us get into our bunks yet, so I sipped at the soup. It was nothing better than flavored water. But it was warm. So blessedly warm.
My dry mouth tried to hang on to every last drop as I swallowed it down. The bread I couldn't eat. Not yet. I didn't put it in the waist of my pants this time, though. I clung to it like it was a precious jewel, hoarding it like a dragon. At last they told us it was time to sleep, and I crawled up into a single bed with 5 other men. There were so many of us we couldn't sleep on our backs, but I fell asleep right away just the same. Just being out of the cold felt like paradise. It seemed I had just closed my eyes when morning came, and the capos roused us up out of our beds. In the light of day, we could see the camp was filled with corpses. Sometimes they lay alone, up against the wall of a barrack, as though they had simply fallen asleep there. Sometimes there were piles of them, built neatly in rows of 4, one level turned this way, the next level turned that way, so they would stack evenly. Sometimes the bodies looked like they had just been tossed aside where they had died, in the middle of a path, out behind the latrine. I had seen death many times by now. I had seen men killed, and I had watched men die of starvation and cold right in front of me. But here in Sachsenhausen, death was so common, so ordinary, that the dead were like fallen trees in the forest. So unremarkable that they were only moved when they got in the way. Before roll call, we would wash, the Nazis told us, and they marched us out to some pumps. There were no brushes, no soap, no towels, but I rinsed myself off anyway. The water was freezing, but I was filthy from the march. As I ran a wet finger across my teeth, a memory suddenly came to me, unbidden. I remembered the first day my mother had brought me home a toothbrush. I must have been no more than 3 or 4. The toothbrush was shiny and plastic and green. That moment seemed like a million years ago. Had I ever really owned something so amazing as a toothbrush? Had I ever really lived in a world with such wondrous things in it? Even the simplest of possessions seemed like treasures now. On the way to roll call, I ate what I could of last night's bread. I had clutched it throughout the night and woke to find myself still protecting it. The soup and sleep and bread had done me good. I was no prize now, all bones and skin and shaking hands, but I wasn't so far gone that I couldn't work. The Nazis lined us up for roll call near the front gate, which had the words, "Work makes you free," on it, just like at Auschwitz. Our new masters didn't seem interested in making us work, though. Not right away. Instead, we stood at attention, our feet sinking into the freezing mud while they called our numbers. Again and again they went through the roll call. Sleet began to fall, and the Nazis left us standing in the yard while they went inside to warm themselves by the fire. They watched us from the windows, making sure none of us moved. We stood there for hours, for no reason other than the delight of our captors. One man wiped the wet sleet from his face, and the Nazis saw him. They rushed outside and beat him, then ordered him to give what they called the Sachsenhausen salute. They forced him to squat with his hands held out in front of him. If he moved in any way, if his arms lowered or his legs moved or he fell over on his side, the Nazis would kill him. And they never let him up, either. It was torture. Everyone could see that. Our legs were barely strong enough to hold us up, let alone to squat for hours. Even a healthy person would fall over in time. The man's legs began to shake, and his arms started to quiver, but still he held the salute. It was only later, when the Nazis had resumed the roll call and we had all forgotten about him, that the man finally fell over. The Nazis ran to beat him, but he never felt it. He was unconscious. Maybe even dead. I didn't know. The guards dragged him away, and I never saw him again. Suddenly, one of the prisoners near the end of the line broke off and ran. The Nazis saw him right away and yelled for the guards at the gate to catch him, but he wasn't headed for the gate. In a stumbling, broken run, the prisoner threw himself on the high-voltage electric barbed wire that lined the fence. His body sparked and thrashed in the wires and bled as the barbs cut him. Within seconds, his body hung dead and limp,
The Nazis had to turn off the electric fence to get him out. His shirt and pants were scorched from the electricity, and his skin was black where the wires had touched him. I couldn't look, but at the same time, I couldn't look away. The Germans laughed as they threw his body down in front of us for everyone to see.
"Would any other Jews like to throw themselves on the fence?"
they asked.
"Go now! We won't stop you! We'll be glad to be rid of you!"
No one else took them up on their offer. After roll call, we were finally put to work. I broke rocks again in the quarry pit. Why the Germans needed so much gravel, I never understood. But I broke big rocks into medium-sized rocks, and medium-sized rocks into small rocks, and small rocks into gravel for them. Pound, 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 pound. My hammer getting heavier and heavier with each strike. At lunch, a half dozen other young men and I were pulled away from our scant meals of watery soup and hard bread. We looked at one another nervously. Was this it? Were we all going to be lined up along a trench and shot? I fought down waves of terror as I walked. Had I survived the death march and gotten my strength back, such as it was, all so I could die in a muddy ditch? I didn't want to die. Not after surviving so long. Not after coming so far. I scanned the camp as we walked, watching for where they were taking us. If it was a death pit, what would I do? Run? Turn and fight? Yell and scream? Or would I let them shoot me without fighting back so that no one else would have to suffer because of me? But it wasn't a ditch the Nazis took us to. It was the soldiers' mess hall. I was even more confused. Were they going to feed us? In the soldiers' canteen? No. It was a trick, of course. All part of the Nazis' game. And in Sachsenhausen, they played the game with relish. The other boys and I were lined up in front of the soldiers' tables, and we were told to sing. For an hour we were their choir, our weak, raspy voices serenading them as they laughed and talked and ate. And the food they ate! Big, heaping plates of meat and potatoes and gravy and steaming black coffee. I tried to look away so my stomach wouldn't rumble. But just the smell of it made my mouth water. They weren't going to feed us any of it, of course. When they were finished eating, we were sent back to our barracks, where we found no food left for us. That afternoon, they put me to work chopping firewood to heat the soldiers' quarters. Chop. 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 Every swing meant survival, I told myself. Work to live. Live until the Allies come. There were planes overhead here, too, and the rumbles of explosions in the distance. Berlin was under attack. The war had come to Germany. But would the war end before the Nazis killed me? That night at roll call, the Sachsenhausen guards wanted entertainment, so they had a boxing tournament. They made some of the prisoners be the boxers, and force the rest of us to watch. Bergen-Belsen Concentration Camp, 1945. Chapter 24. When the guards at Sachsenhausen tired of us, they shipped us off by train to Bergen-Belsen. We traveled by cattle car again, and again prisoners died of starvation and suffocation along the way. Once the Nazis dropped 3 loaves of bread in our car through a hole at the top, just to watch us fight for it. As our train pushed farther north, there was more room to breathe as the dead dropped to the floor. The train arrived at Bergen-Belsen in the morning, my 7th concentration camp in less than 3 years. The commandant of the camp took one look at us and started screaming at our guards.
"What did you bring me? Look at these skeletons! How do you expect these walking dead to work?"
The commandant moved among us, pointing at prisoners.
"Him, him, him, him,"
he said, and soldiers pulled the men out of the ranks. I puffed up my chest to try and look as strong and healthy as I could, but the commandant took one look at me and moved on past, picking other prisoners. My heart cried out.
No! I had to be strong enough to work. Work was the only way to survive.
When the commandant had pulled 75 prisoners out of our lines, he had them march to the other side of the tracks and ordered his soldiers to shoot them. They were gunned down before we surviving, wide-eyed prisoners even had time to react. I quickly turned away. I couldn't watch. The commandant hadn't chosen the strongest. He'd taken the weakest. I just couldn't tell the difference. How he could, I didn't understand. I felt terrible for it, but secretly I was glad it had been somebody else who was killed, and not me.
Take the others back to the barracks,
the commandant said with disgust.
No work for a week, until they regain their strength.
I couldn't believe my ears. No work for a week? What kind of trick was this? I could see the other prisoners glancing at one another, wondering the same thing. But it was no trick. When we got back to the barracks, we were fed the thickest, richest soup I had eaten in 6 years, and big pieces of fresh bread, hot from the oven. I was so thin and miserable I thought I could gain weight just from the smell alone. There was no gas chamber here either, and no chimneys burning red in the night. Maybe Bergen-Belsen really was better than all the other camps. Maybe this was the place where I could survive until the war ended. I scarfed my piece of bread and washed it down with that delicious, meaty soup. But an hour later, I learned that even in kindness the Nazis were cruel. Every one of us woke with the most terrible stomach cramps we'd ever had. Our poor stomachs weren't used to such hearty food. We spent the night changing places with one another on the two barrels left in the barrack. I finally drifted off close to dawn, still hunched over from the pain in my gut. The next day, they brought us more of the thick soup and warm bread, but this time I was careful. I remembered reading about medicine back in Krakow and learning that dry toast helped settle an upset stomach. So I traded my soup for more bread and toasted the bread over the wood stove in the barrack. I hated to give up the delicious soup, but the bread sat better with me, and I slowly began to get stronger. A week later, as promised, we were put back to work. It was the same as always, chopping wood, breaking rocks, building new camp buildings. One day I was hard at work hauling boards for the walls of a barrack when one of our new capos called me over. I studied him as I approached. He had a big, round face that was covered with acne pits and scars. Without a word, he punched me in the face. My world exploded. Pain shot from my nose to my brain, and my head snapped back like I'd been hit with a shovel. I fell to the ground, clutching my face.
"What did you do that for?"
I cried.
"What did I do?"
I knew I shouldn't have said anything, but I didn't care. I was too stunned. My nose was already swelling up so badly I couldn't breathe through it.
"You looked at me the wrong way,"
the capo told me. His eyes glittered with amusement before he told me to get up and get back to work. My head was throbbing. It was hard to stand. Dark red blood splotched my blue and gray striped uniform. I held the back of my sleeve to my nose, gently, tenderly. It still hurt so badly, trying to stem the bleeding. I hoped my nose wasn't broken. If it was, there was nothing I could do about it. I made it back to the boards I'd dropped, trying not to let my tears spill over.
"Moonface,"
one of the other prisoners said as he fell in alongside me.
"What?"
I said.
"Moonface. That's what we call him."
He nodded to the big round-faced capo who'd slugged me. "They say he killed 3 men before the war. The Germans put him in prison, but when the war started they made him a capo. We've got murderers for guards." I knew our guards were murderers now, but I didn't know some of them were convicted killers in the past. I made sure to stay well clear of Moonface after that, but somehow I always managed to be assigned to work duty near him. He seemed to notice me wherever I went too, and soon I became his pet project. Moonface kicked me and hit me and beat me whenever he could.
Bergen-Belsen might have been the place for me to survive until the end of the war, but for Moonface. I had to get away from him. When I heard the Nazis were rounding up workers to send them to another camp, I made sure I was at the front of the line. But the Nazis weren't looking for volunteers. They had their own method for choosing us already figured out.
"Only the strongest and healthiest prisoners will be transferred," the Nazi announced. "To prove which of you is most able, there will be a race."
More games. Each of us had to take off our clothes, roll them into bundles, and dash from one side of the barracks to the other. The Nazis watched and laughed as we staggered through the maze of beds. When it was my turn, I took off my uniform and was surprised again at how skinny I was. Even after a week of rest and better food, my arms and legs still looked like toothpicks.
"You!"
one of the Nazis yelled at me.
"Run!"
I ran as fast as I could. I had to win this race. I had to get out of Bergen-Belsen. I had to get away from Moonface. I was running for my life. I stumbled around one of the beds and crashed into another, bruising my thigh very badly, but I still flew through the doorway at the other side of the barrack faster than some of the other prisoners. When I burst outside, all I wanted to do was collapse on the ground until my lungs stopped burning and my legs stopped shaking, but I knew if I did that, the Nazis would never pick me to move on. Instead, I forced myself to stand up and look relaxed, like I'd just taken a stroll in the park.
"He can work,"
one of the guards said. I took my time putting my uniform back over my bony body, bending over so they couldn't see me gasping for breath. I spotted Moonface out in the yard, pushing another prisoner to the ground and kicking him. Another cattle car awaited me, and so did another camp. But at least I had gotten away from Moonface for good. Buchenwald Concentration Camp, 1945. Chapter 25. Buchenwald Concentration Camp. Just the looks on the faces of the prisoners already there told me all I needed to know. They were scared, wide-eyed. And not just at roll call or when a capo passed by. It was all the time, like at any moment death might come for you. And at Buchenwald, as I was to learn, death came in many guises. After our first roll call, I was assigned to the stone quarry. Instead of breaking rocks, I was told to carry them up a long hill. I had to carry the big rocks on my back with my arms behind me to hold them in place. If you took a stone too large, you would drop it and the Nazis would shoot you. If you took a stone too small, the Nazis would shoot you for being lazy. Picking just the right size stone became a kind of competition among us. Another fine joke from the Nazis. Some of the prisoners pulled carts instead of carrying stones on their backs, but that wasn't a job you wanted either. The Jews were chained to the carts like a team of draft horses and whipped like animals. Only these animals were also required to sing. The Germans called them their singing horses. They had to carry a tune as they hauled enormous loads of rock up the hill. I had already been part of the prisoner chorus at Sachsenhausen. I was grateful I didn't have to do it strapped to a horse cart here. It was only at our second roll call of the day that I saw the Buchenwald Zoo. I had seen the fenced-in area at the first roll call, but not the animals. There were deer, monkeys, even bears. Bears! Right there in the concentration camp. The zoo, I learned, was the idea of the camp's commandant, Karl Koch, and his wife, Ilse.